Thank you, Dan. Dan's work is so unusual and so relevant to our time, it's hard really to describe it. And we have a very distinguished panel of scholars with us who will be bringing up some of the reasons why we believe that might be the case, at least discussing some of the issues. Our first panelist is Barton Bernstein, who's professor of history at Stanford University. He received his PhD in history from Harvard University. He's the recipient of two Kuntz Prizes, the Goldstein Prize and the Johnson Prize. Professor Bernstein is a world-renowned expert on U.S. foreign policy, the arms race, U.S. science policy, and weaponry. Bart.
Let me say I'm delighted to be here, and I'm delighted to be here not just because I needed something to do in the evening other than sitting home and watching Law and Order, but rather this is an opportunity to say to Dan publicly what many of us have said over the years behind his back privately, that is thanks on behalf of American democracy, and thanks for doing something which 30 years later as we know how it turned out, and he didn't spend a decade in prison, we can look at it as if it was comparatively low risk. But moving forward in time, as historians try to do in retrospect to re-examine and understand, things could have really turned out quite differently. And it's an indication of the time that there were not multiple Dan Ellsbergs vying for the opportunity to disclose the secrets of the American government. Indeed, one can ask the larger question, and that is, it's a question that Dan implicitly asked, and I want to raise it explicitly and address it obliquely and badly. Why do good people lie on behalf of major issues? Maybe it's that they're not good. Maybe it's that ideology often urges them on behalf of a larger purpose. Maybe the whole pattern of social recruitment is that you don't allow into positions of power people who are, and I mean this puckishly, people who are irresponsible and who believe that there's a larger obligation to the polity than advancing themselves and their friends. That is the necessity of efficacy of counsel in not offending your friends, in moving up in the bureaucracy, in moving on for honor and receiving various rewards. These are not naked purchases. These are the subtle seductions of social recruitment. One meets them in all aspects of life. Lots of cases, most of us lie part of the time. Only occasionally do some people get to lie on matters of major significance where the cost is not just an injured reputation or a lamented situation, but rather life and death. As to the question as why do good people lie, I hope you realize that I've skirted the surface, given you a few notions, answered the question inadequately. And now I'd like to move on from that to a kind of oblique assault from various perspectives on that question. Governments, of course, use security and classification to protect some real secrets that merit protection. How to build nuclear weapons would be a perfect example. By and large, security is, of course, used to protect a government internally from its own constituency. This is one of the wonderful aspects of bipartisanship, and it was something developed well in World War II under a master of dissembling, propelled through various agencies with a larger budget after a few years by Democrats and Republicans. For some, the argument would be it came to crudescence and debacle in Watergate. But the road to Watergate is paved in a nice bipartisan fashion. a different political culture in the early 60s, and Kennedy could have come a cropper. A slightly different political culture a few years later, and it could have happened to Johnson. It is wonderfully ironic, and one has to savor the fact that Nixon, who would have prosecuted Dan, was in turn, if you will, obliquely threatened with the prospect of prosecution and left amid a debacle. Seldom does history get the right guys, but this is a case where at least briefly, before there was a new Nixon, followed by a new Nixon, followed by a new Nixon, and the multiple emanations of self-creation. But my point, I want to move on to something actually more troubling, and that is, think back to the Pentagon Papers, either as history or for those of you beyond the age of 48 or 50, as experience. Had the papers been available in 1967 and finished and given to the American press, we can guarantee without full proof, but there is a kind of Gedanken oblique experiment you could do, no major paper in America would have published those papers. It was a violation of secrecy. The government knew best. Lies were necessary. Consent had to be manufactured. Legitimacy should not be assaulted. And the war, if not a good cause, was at least a reasonable cause. What changed? Well, we didn't win the war. The largest thing that changed and produced delegitimacy was America did not win speedily and at a comparatively low risk. What began for many Americans as, if not a just war, not clearly an unjust war, to use the double negative, became progressively a dubious enterprise and became for some, I think not most Americans, but for some, and this was part of the odyssey that Dan himself went through, it became an immoral, it became an atrocity. By 70, 71, the major press could contemplate publishing the Pentagon Papers. But even then, I suspect, strangely, it was easier to do it with a Republican in the White House than a Democrat, certainly in the case of the Washington Post. Deeply beholden to Lyndon Johnson, sharing the counsel of Clark Clifford in particular. I suspect that had Johnson been elected in 68, had he run and been elected, the Pentagon Papers probably would not have come out in the early 70s. It's not an argument one can prove, but I'd like you to contemplate an alternative past, which is at least plausible as a way of getting purchase on a larger political culture. The press for years served legitimacy. The early protests by the press were the war wasn't being fought well. It wasn't being fought reasonably. People like Halberstam moved from lamenting the way it was fought to beginning to wonder why it was fought, to suggesting that perhaps the enterprise was less than legitimate. As Dan pointed out, and many of you are drawn today, and quite properly many of us worry duly, about the prospect of an imminent war. We have a president who's promulgated a new doctrine that others have believed in, but none has publicly promulgated. That is the doctrine of preemption. The right of the United States unilaterally to decree enmity and to take action appropriate on the basis of its own sense of rectitude. That's not exactly what the document says, but that's what the document really means. We will choose our enemies, act accordingly, and use whatever criteria seem to be suitable in the situation. Iraq, we're told, is a threat. Why? Well, first of all, there's a madman. It would be hard, I think, for most of us to be delighted by the prospect of Saddam Hussein ruling a country. But on the other hand, madman is rather extreme. The Kuwait situation could be interpreted back in 90 very differently. And indeed, one can argue this is a man who uses force against his own people, against Kurds who are half his own people and not, and against neighboring areas. But madness, by and large, he's far from being mad, although undoubtedly immoral. He will have nuclear weapons. Only mature powers that have used nuclear weapons should be permitted to have them. This is a theory of oligopoly in international relations. has raised the barrier of entry so high that only the possessors can legitimize their enterprise. Others lack maturity. They are madmen. I agree. I would much prefer not to have him have nuclear weapons. I'd much prefer none of the possessors, including a small country in the Middle East that officially doesn't have them. Because if it had them, America could not provide aid. And therefore, we all abide by the fiction that no social scientist or historian believes for a moment that country doesn't have nuclear weapons. We're told, worst of all, Saddam Hussein and Iraq are involved with al-Qaeda. And how is this known? Well, it's known somewhere between divine intervention, the Decalogue handed down by Texas Baptists, and the intuition of unique wisdom through the angel Rumsfeld. Admittedly, I've taken cheap shots in hyperbolic rhetoric to delegitimize arguments which on their face are unproved and are largely, in many ways, I think, literally absurd. If there's a case for the al-Qaeda connection, let the government make it not through assertion, but through evidence. Even the New York Times, in today's editorial, has basically said the case is unproved. Come on, guys, be straightforward. Moving from the gray ghost of lackluster prose and polite civility in the New York Times, basically what's being said is, so far we've heard lies. We, the Times, are not going to call these things lies. Provide your evidence. Why Iraq as an enemy? Had anybody said to me, and I think most of the panelists, a year ago, October 2001, a year hence there'll be a war planned against Iraq. What do you think the likelihood is? I think I would have bet on UFOs first. Why the war? Well, let me say, I'm one of those historians who, respecting the craft, recognizes that I can offer only tentative answers and amalgamate them without being able adequately to weigh the factors. But the amalgamation would go something like this without necessarily indicating priority of place. Part of it is that America has the power to do it in a way that during the Cold War, similar ventures would have been impossible because of larger threats. And having the power is not insignificant. The desire without power is less likely to be acted upon. Beyond that, undoubtedly, the events of 9/11 have predisposed an American public to believe in the miasma of fear that enmity lurks anywhere where allegation is made, evidence undoubtedly lurks behind it and need not be provided. Without 9/11, this would be impossible. But why does George Bush want to do this? One offering has been he's an empty vessel into which his advisors pour advice. I confess my distaste for Bush inclines me to like that interpretation for visceral reasons, but for intellectual reasons, I'm actually inclined with inadequate evidence to reject it. I think this is somebody who does believe what he's arguing, even though he has to dissemble to legitimize the case, eliminate certain evidence, and claim other evidence. So what is going on? Well, part of it is the opportunity, believed, I fear, that this is going to be the creation through war of a Jeffersonian or some kind of democracy in the Middle East resembling Japan after World War II. All analogies are both like and unlike other things, but this is an analogy that really comes close to, or indeed strains credulity. But it may well be believed, we have good reason to believe that Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld and other people believe it, and it may well be that Bush believes it. Undoubtedly, oil plays a role. If you ask the question, why is North Korea a trouble and Iraq a threat? It's not power. It's not proximity to the United States. It's something else, and one should not minimize oil. Why are the Russians opposed to such a venture? Well, in part, they're locked up in the oil business while Iraq and the United States is not. That's not a whole explanation, and a whole explanation would be far more nuanced, but that's not insignificant. Could this be partly, as some have suggested, George W.'s effort to solve the problems that his father couldn't solve? Well, seems quite likely. I have 1 minute left, and thus I'm going to summarize and then run over 30 seconds. It's a panel on empire, and what's better than an academic imperialist? Let me say that the fact that Scowcroft and Baker, among others, came out in op-ed pages against this venture suggests that George Bush I is probably himself disinclined. And thus I want to offer a speculation that can't be proved, is fiercely speculative, it'll interest some of you, intrigue more, and some will reject it. This may be the case of the lackluster son who wasn't expected to go very far, besting the father. I don't want to argue it's Oedipal, but there may be, the liability of the argument is it's unprovable at present. It's speculative, and be aware that it's speculative. Beyond that, this does offer, we're told, to return to the earlier theme, a set of opportunities. In the Middle East, we can either blow up the Middle East, which is most likely, or create democracy, which is least likely. If I were pro-Israeli, if I were Sharon with both conscience, conviction, and concern, not somewhat distorted, I would think the worst thing that could happen would be an American attack on Iraq. For the most proximate hostage state for Iraq and possibly others will be Israel. But beyond that, how is this war being sold? It's being sold through the capacity to manufacture consent at a time that the American people want to trust the president, when we feel we're beleaguered by massive terrorism and thus in peril. And indeed, it allows a president in such a situation, with a too frequently trusting press, to claim, to allege, to deceive, and to lie. In the short run, this is how legitimacy is created and maintained. In the long run, it sometimes comes to shambles and sometimes doesn't. Let's hope for the best. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bart. Our next panelist is Edwin Firmage, who is the Samuel Thurman Professor of Law at the University of Utah. Among his books are To Chain the Dog of War, and incidentally, there are copies in the front, which we hope that you'll pick up. He's also the author of The International Legal System and Religion and Law. We're very pleased to have Ed Firmage.
My Scottish forebears gave me very little hair and very little height. Nothing happens when I stand up. Dan has upset my heart and my head from any dialogue between them, because we started almost the same day in different ways. We've been comparing notes and reading each other's stuff for some time now. I was starting with Hubert Humphrey as a very young minted law professor from the University of Chicago. My whole job, thank God, was working in civil rights. I worked with Martin Luther King a long time ago. Names other than that you probably don't know, and I feel very sad that you don't. Roy Wilkins of the NAACP, Whitney Young of the Urban League, Sergeant Shriver, John W. Gardner, who is my godfather and my dear friend. Huge losses. They're all dead, and they're in my heart. I went through some of the same stuff. I watched Hubert, a good man, a man I love, paining terribly over a war he detested in the most god-awful job ever created by the American Constitution. In John Nance Gardner's words, it's not worth a bucket of warm spit, and he spoke as Vice President of the United States. I started like Dan as my version of a cold warrior, which is pretty pacifistic guy, really. My own religion didn't permit me to do much other than that. But I didn't like the Soviets, and I thought communism stunk, and I wanted to do what I could about it. I was a Boy Scout in Korea, and I was a father of a couple of kids and a young guy in my 20s in the White House. At the same time, Dan was doing what he was doing. And so his book, as I was been reading it, has tore my heart out and scrambled my brain. But what's left of this old brain, my job is to tell you about the war clause. And it says this: Congress shall declare war and grant letters of marque and reprisal. That's all it says. But that says a lot, a great deal. When Thomas Jefferson, who wrote To Chain the Dog with a title we stole from Jefferson, he was ambassador to Paris. And his disciples in the convention in Philadelphia in 1787 said, sent him the draft when he was our ambassador there. He said, wrote back a letter saying, "Thank God you've chained the dog of war, because you've taken the war power from a," now will be Firmage interpreting Jefferson, from a president or a king who's on a boring Thursday afternoon likely to declare war, and given it to Congress who have to answer to the people. You've chained the dog of war from a president or a king by whatever name, and that inclination to make executive war by dispatch to a deliberative body. And there was a huge reason. These were Republican Democratic Whigs. The Tories were out of town in Canada, dead or having sudden conversion. And they didn't like war, and they didn't like an executive propensity to war, and they thought anticipatory self-defense was an oxymoron used by idiots or knaves or fools or all three. And they knew about, they had no idea of delegating the war power. No, it had to be a Congress of the United States sitting right now and judging the facts, and you don't delegate it. And Bobby Bord's the only one in the Senate making much sense, along with Senator Kennedy. Several of the senators have been calling me during this time. They take their job seriously. Senator from Pennsylvania, his staff called, others. I've testified there many times. And they were debating Chapter 13, and I forgot it was Chapter 13, but he said, Chapter 13, non-delegation. We don't want to do this. We don't want to do this. Because the presumption, the whole presumption of the War Clause is that peace is to be preserved and nurtured and cultured and loved and defended. And you don't denuclearize the world by starting to knock them off one by one by waging war. You don't wage war against people you don't like. They're evil and they're so forth. My heavens, we could depopulate our own government with half that. And you declare war. You declare war. You don't... I have to stop myself from naughty words. But you don't say one thing when you mean, if you're going to go to war, say this is war, people. You're going to go to war. We're going to take you to war. Watch how many people support you then when you do that. It drops a long way. And state your grievances. We're going to war for this, 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 and this reason. If you want to see a good declaration of war, pick up the Declaration of Independence and read it. Thomas Jefferson did a damn good job. Remonstrance and grievance. Here's what you did. Here's what you did. Here's what you did. Here's what you did. And here's why we're doing it. And here's how we've tried peace. Give peace a chance. The international legal system says this. And Congress has the constitutional Article 1 right to determine what is international law for the purposes of the United States of America. It's by fact-finding and good offices and conciliation and negotiation and arbitration and talk and talk and talk. It doesn't work any other way. I spend a lot of my time now working with the Dalai Lama. And he knows about war. And he knows about alienage. And he knows about violence. And he knows it doesn't work. And my friends, it doesn't work. It just simply doesn't. Another of many items tying our lives together: an abhorrence of nuclear weapons. I was studying at Brigham Young University a million years ago when Henry Kissinger was at Harvard, and I read these awful books about nuclear weaponry, and I had an abhorrence for that. And talk about sinning or abusing your own people. I live in Utah. We we are the home for almost every bit of the chemical and the biological and the nuclear crap that we've ever had. And I'll tell you something, my friends. I started the fight against the MX missile a long time ago, and it started right here in your state after 2 years in my own, talking to churches and church leaders who came out against that horror story. The government has never even had the courtesy to declare war on us. If you want to talk about harming your own people, a lot of us have cancer. A lot of us think we know why. It's what we're living. The statement of spiritual masters, living by the sword and dying by the sword, can have many incarnations. Living nearby the sword can most certainly cause one to die nearby the sword. I fear a time when we won't any longer possess free will, when we can get to a point where we can't get back. The tricky part is you can only see it in retrospect. Years ago when I decided to go to the University of Chicago, that everything's been downhill since, gone to hell since University of Chicago. But it's always in retrospect. I fear with nuclear weapons as the matrix within which all this silly stuff about war, talk about the mouse that roared, Iraq. I fear what it will put out, what it will happen, not because we were particularly bad. Most of the men I knew here were good. Some of them, not blessed with an abundance of brains, but they were basically decent people. I fear when we can't get there. Now, I've got a 1 minute notice. Then I will destruct. Here's what I fear. I've written on nuclear stuff since 1962 and all this stuff for a long, long time. I fear a time when we can't get back. Put in religious terms, I fear moving to a point where we can't repent or turn away. In tragedy, this is tragedy, when good people see, like the last weeks before World War I, see where you're going and everybody tries to stop, and yet you can't. You can't get back. In the play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, based on Prince Hamlet, these two guys, who set in motion, interestingly, by being spies at the behest of the king, not telling the truth, they set in motion the death of Hamlet, the king, his stepfather, the queen, Laertes, his dear friend. Everybody's dying, dead. And Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are scratching their head. They're in a little boat crossing the channel. I think they have a letter that says, give the bearer safe harbor, sanctuary. It says, in fact, put these two people to death fast, but they don't know that. But Rosencrantz turns to Guildenstern. They didn't like the result. He said, there must have been a time, somewhere near the beginning, when we could have said no. I suggest that, my friends. Thank you.